Hello, welcome to Take Back the Universe Loves to Laugh here at Penguin Radio 102.3 FM or worldwide, radio.dominican.edu. I'm your host, Barbara McVeigh. We got big things to talk about here on Take Back, and we have an agenda. As our planet faces global climate change, melting polar ice caps, and ocean acidification, we like to remain positive. There's hope. We're still alive. Here at Take Back, we try to get deep into understanding these issues and ask big questions about what does it mean to be human, and where are we going wrong on planet Earth? Each Tuesday at noon, here on Take Back, we will have thinkers, poets, writers, educators, musicians, and environmentalists help us get it right and navigate this crazy journey called life. Maybe we'll get inspired to make some big changes and look at who we have been and why. Today's guest, Professor Laura Stivers, is with us to talk about homelessness. Her book, Disrupting Homelessness, Alternative Christian Approaches, digs deep into challenging, profound ideologies about homeownership and values that we've been taught to uphold. Maybe we don't have it right. As homeless rates soar in the United States, food banks become overwhelmed, and the basic wage worker can no longer make ends meet, this is the time to talk about alternative approaches. Laura Stivers is Dean of the Humanities Department and former Associate Professor of Ethics here at Dominican University of California. Welcome, Professor Stivers.
Hello.
You take on a big issue in your book, which is a fascinating read and is available online, I might add, as well as our local library. How did you get involved in this topic? What drew you into talking about homelessness and
Several things got me involved. First of all, my work has been in economic and environmental justice, so the topic of homelessness is an economic justice issue. I went to grad school in Berkeley, and I worked with a popular economic education group, and we developed trainings for different organizations that were doing social justice work, and we developed some trainings on homelessness and housing for a Bay Area homeless group. So I learned first about homelessness really through that work. Then later when I was teaching in North Carolina, my background is Presbyterian, and I was asked by the Presbyterian Church to serve on their writing task force to rewrite their statement on homelessness. And everybody on the committee was either working with affordable housing or the homeless, and I was the theological ethicist and hadn't done a lot of work with the issue of homelessness. So I did some research to write a paper, and when I gave the paper, everybody said, oh, you really need to turn this into a book. So I went back to my university and asked for a sabbatical, and that's where the book came out of.
Wow.
Yeah.
So can you tell us a little bit about this idea of home ownership, and you know, we all do want a home. This is what we've been taught. Is we work hard with Habitat for Humanity, Jimmy Carter's organization. In fact, I think he collapsed just the other day at age 92, building a home for people in the community who can't afford homes.
Well, in my book, I look at two different Christian organizations, in part not to put all the emphasis on those organizations, but to look at two different ideologies around homelessness. And so one organization was the Association of Gospel Rescue Missions, and that was to look at the ideologies we have about individual people who are homeless. The second organization I looked at was Habitat for Humanity. I picked both of these organizations because they are national organizations, and a lot of churches work with both these organizations, and they typify particular approaches. So Rescue Missions is a direct charity approach, and then Habitat is an approach that promotes home ownership, so trying to do a little bit more of a structural perspective. Just a caveat, my grandfather worked with Habitat and did a build with Jimmy Carter, and I think Habitat's a great organization. What I did find in all their literature, however, is that this real emphasis that is not just Habitat, it's our whole the United States has pushed this, is that home ownership is the end all be all, that that's what we strive for. And a lot of their literature that the homeowner is the respectable good citizen. And of course, the typical image of the homeowner was a nuclear family, right, usually white. And I found that a bit problematic, because the flip side of that then is if home ownership is the thing that we aspire to and that's what good citizens do, then the flip side is that if you're a renter, somehow you're less than. And so Habitat is not clearly not trying to look down at renters, but their ideology of uplifting home ownership as being so good ends up doing that. And I don't want to put down home ownership, because people do gain equity by owning a home. It can lead to stability in neighborhoods, so there's definitely some benefits to home ownership. But part of this ideology of uplifting it so much led to some of our problems in the mortgage foreclosure crisis. A lot of unscrupulous dealers offered subprime loans to families who really weren't making enough wage-wise or salary-wise to afford the loans. They weren't educated enough to realize what a subprime loan was, that they get low interest rates, and then all of a sudden the interest rate changes. It's not a fixed rate, and it balloons, and then they can't make their payments. And part of the way they sold this is that people wanted to own a home. That's what would make them be respectful, respected in society. And I... Again, I think homeownership is fine, but I think we really need to be looking at how we're going to promote more affordable rental housing in our communities, because especially now when people's job security is not as good, when wages have gone down since the 80s and people really aren't making as much, what they really need is affordable rental housing.
Which really lacks here in our own county, Marin. And it's interesting you're saying this, because I used to be a homeowner. I'm now a renter. And I'll tell you, I honestly feel that stigma of renting. And mm-hmm. even in the building where I rent, it's called the building in the area. Yeah. And there's this perception of the people who live in this building as being somehow, you know, they're African Americans, or Latinos, a lot of house cleaners, service workers, lovely, wonderful people, because I've gotten to know them all. Mm-hmm. But there is incredible social stigma about that. Even the police talk about that in that community. And, it, you know, so I get to see that firsthand. But what's interesting, too, is just the sense of lack of, when you are renting, and I appreciate what you were saying, is a sense of no control. I mean, it's a ridiculous amount of rent. They actually have a monopoly in not only Marin County and San Francisco, but the rent just went up again.
this is the real problem. I mean, actually, I ended up buying a home when I first moved here, and I'm really glad I did, because the rents have gone up so much that my house payments are less than I would be paying in rent for the place I'm living in. And so those who can get the loans, have the salary that they can get loans, or have family like I did that helped me with the down payment, end up paying way less in housing than the people who can't afford it and really can't afford to be paying such rents. I mean, right now, I just saw an article the other day. Most San Franciscans who are renting are paying over 40% of their income for rent.
Wow.
And 30% is considered affordable.
And considering the rates that some San Franciscans, at least in the tech business, are making, I mean, I saw some figure, I don't know if this is absolutely right, but if you make $90K in San Francisco, you are struggling today.
Yeah, exactly. And so and it's supply and demand. I mean, there's less than 1% of open housing in Marin, and so... they can charge high rents.
So I think of the person, the average person making, what, $15 an hour, let's say, who can't afford to live in that one community where they're working, because you have to have service workers. You need the cleaners, you need the gardeners, you need the nannies in order to sustain a higher lifestyle, if you want to call it that. But they can't afford to live in that very community. Therefore, they have to have a car, because public transportation is pretty horrid, right?
Right now, over 66,000 people are commuting into Marin each day.
How many?
Over 66,000.
66,000 are commuting into Marin to work.
Yeah.
Where are they coming from?
Maybe that sounds wrong. Maybe it's 6,600.
Well, even that would be a lot.
66,000 sounds a little high.
Well, I mean, but that would be an interesting number just to know because that's pretty.
But there's a lot of people commuting in because they can't afford to live here.
So, and then you have to have the cost of an automobile, which is not cheap. You have to have the.
Plus, this is tied to environmental. I mean, we've been talking about global warming and that being a huge issue right now. If you have all these people driving back and forth in their cars and traffic's an issue here.
Traffic is worse than an issue here. What's happened?
And then that also is not good for communities because you've got people in their cars all the time. They're not in their communities and interacting with people they live by.
Well, and just the values of if a person makes lower than a certain number, are they deemed bad? Where did we come up with this idea that they can't be trusted?
I don't know. I've been working in, I mean, I have a full-time job, so I'm not working in promoting affordable housing full force, but I've been working with some groups who are organizing to promote affordable housing in Marin, and I've been amazed at the just vehement opposition to any affordable housing here. There's a lot of racial undertones of we don't want those people in our neighborhood.
You talk about that in your book, a little bit about the history of housing and government housing and so forth. Could you share that story and that history?
If I can remember all the history. I wrote the book a while ago.
Sure.
Well, public housing was created, I believe, and I might get all my facts wrong, but in the 30s, and it was originally created for white people and was well kept up. And, you know, your teachers, your police officers, firefighters, and so on lived in public housing. And it was well maintained. And then I think it was before the 30s. I'd have to look back to my notes. But then civil rights happened, and originally public housing was not open to African Americans or Hispanics and others. And once civil rights legislation passed, it was open to them, and then the public housing got a stigma. And we started to defund housing and urban, the Department of Housing and Urban Development, and so public housing started to deteriorate. There was an image that all public housing was high-rise apartments, when in fact a lot of the public housing was in mixed-income communities with smaller buildings. But the stigma started, and we pretty much cut the funding, especially when Reagan came in the 80s. He just slashed the HUD budget. And now we really aren't creating any more public housing. The one thing we are spending money on is Housing First, which is to house people who are chronically homeless. And Housing First, you would put them in housing whether they have addictions or mental illness or anything. Just get them in housing, because the reason this caught on is it actually was cheaper to house them than to pay for them revolving in and out of jails and in and out of hospitals. We were spending more taxpayer money doing that. And so, and there's been really great success. I mean, Utah has really promoted this quite heavily, and they've decreased chronic homelessness by 91%. So it's worked. The other form of housing assistance we have is Section 8 housing, which the government pays a part of the housing, and people only have to pay, I think it is 30% of their income towards housing. The problem with that is we have not kept up with the need, and so many cities, the Section 8 lists are closed. There is not even a waiting list. The other problem with it is sometimes the amounts that they'll give aren't high enough, and so it pushes all the people into poorer neighborhoods where they can actually afford a place with the Section 8 housing, and where people will take the Section 8 voucher. People renting don't have to take it.
Right.
It's still a good program, but there's a lot more need than we're meeting with that. And then there's also developers, if they put, and I don't know all the details specifically, but if they put a certain percent of their new development towards affordable housing, they can get tax credits and such. But the housing only needs to stay affordable, I think, I can tell I wrote this book a while ago, for about 15 years or so. So it doesn't last forever.
All right.
What was the other thing I was going to say about? Oh, so those are the obvious policies of housing assistance, but really the biggest housing assistance is not to the poor. The majority of our housing assistance goes to, and I've listed in my book, I don't remember all of them exactly, but the main one is the home mortgage, deduction you can take on your taxes for a home.
Right.
And you can deduce up to two homes. So we're putting very little money towards housing assistance for the poor, but yet we're letting people deduct up to two homes. And that means they're not paying taxes that could have been used to do housing assistance for the poor.
Right.
There's also three other tax breaks that basically help the rich. And so when we think of housing assistance, we think of public housing or Section 8, but in fact, most of the housing assistance goes to people with incomes over $200,000.
Well, you add to those deductions, if you do business in your home, you also get to deduct that. As an apartment dweller, as a renter, you get no tax benefits whatsoever.
Yep. So, you know, our image is that we are giving all these handouts to the poor, and the opposite is actually true. We're giving the handouts to the rich.
Yeah. How do we solve that one?
Well, it's a matter of political will. I mean, this is true of all public policy. I mean, one of the main points of my book is you can't just address homelessness through housing policy. You need to address it through all sorts of policies. Policies on healthcare, policies on wages, policies on unions, transportation policies, and so on. We've got all sorts of good ideas, and there's think tanks that can give all sorts of ways that we could actually help our communities to flourish and make sure we don't have any people who are homeless. But it means we need to have a political will to make those changes.
We do, or enough anger. And it seems to me that a lot of the people who are on the borderline, who are the service workers making $10, $15 an hour, they don't even know where to begin to ask for help. They're just really bringing together. I work with a local Guatemalan community, a fantastic community that really shares what community is like. I mean, they do an incredible amount of sharing, but they're struggling, you know? I mean, everyone is, it seems, these days. So many people are. But I am able to see just how, you know, not only with the healthcare and the children, but they pull together as a strong community, but they don't know how to speak out. And who do you speak out to? You know, or do you just put your head down and continue working?
The first thing we need to do is to quit separating a group as homeless separate from those who are living in poverty. The issue of homelessness is an issue of poverty.
Okay.
And so we have to address poverty, and it's not just Guatemalan or immigrant communities. It's not just communities of color. I mean, this poverty is an issue across the board in the United States. And if we could stop like blaming the victims and seeing the homeless as somehow just lazy or addicts or, you know, mentally ill, and realize that there's a lot of people that are a paycheck away from being homeless.
Yes.
Especially if they have an accident or a health care, or they have a child born with a disability.
Yes.
I mean, anything can put people over the edge. And some families have, you know, family to fall back on. But especially in many communities where there's been chronic poverty, people don't have anybody to fall back on. And so we really need to address poverty. And that's only going to change if we work. I mean, there needs to be a movement. Mm-hmm. I mean, when we had the Depression in the 30s, there was a movement that said we need to address poverty. We put in the New Deal. We did. We actually made policy changes, structural changes. We had this recession in 2000, starting in 2007 and 2008, and I didn't see the kind of mobilization that we have had before. I'm not sure why not. I mean, we did have the, what was the 1%, that movement.
Oh, right. The 99.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So we've.
And which lasted, which resulted in people living on the streets and collecting, but being booted out by the police. I remember watching that myself in San Francisco.
So
it's like, okay, guys, party's over. Out of here.
There has been some movement, but it hasn't gained traction.
Right.
And now we're in a, you know, in a political situation where it's, hopefully people will start to get angry and start advocating for change. But it, if I get nothing across in my book, the main point is that we have to do structural change. Charity's fine. You have to have soup kitchens. You need to have shelters. All of that's important. But we're not going to solve the problem of homelessness or poverty in general or inequality unless we have structural policy change.
And certainly that comes with class distinctions. And maybe that's part of the discussion, right?
I don't think people realize we have the largest inequality gap that we've ever had. Right. It's as high as the, you know, the robber baron era in the 20s.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure the average American realizes that.
So I have to share a little story that happened to me last weekend. I got pulled into one of these timeshare deals for a weekend, and I had to make a certain amount of money in order to, you know, be eligible. And so I thought, well, I've never done this before. I'm going to go in and see what this is all about. Mm-hmm. And I had to sit for a 4-hour lecture with four people on me about this timeshare idea in order to have the timeshare and the low cost of luxury vacations. You actually have to make a certain amount of money. And after you sit through these timeshare deals, then you get a reward, which I got a $100 visa at the end of this, which was kind of funny. But I was thinking to myself, this is all completely rigged for a person who is making money. You know, so for a low-income person who could probably benefit from a vacation, or however you want to describe it, from something that is low cost, they're not even in the game. They're completely shut out. Yeah. You know, it's a game that is based on how much you have. Which is really funny because, you know, Jimmy Carter talked about this in 1979. Yeah, he gave this great speech called The Crisis of Confidence and said people are being valued for what they have and not what they do. You know, and to me, that's kind of what we're talking about. It's the people who have the homes, who have the things, that have the perception of being higher class, whatever you want, who are being trusted. Mm-hmm. But those who don't have so much, but maybe doing some great work for other people. Mm-hmm. Nonprofit workers, how much do they make? 15, 20 bucks an hour themselves, barely struggling. But God, they're doing all this great work for everybody else, but they're put into that near poverty zone.
And we don't listen to the voices of those on the underside. I mean, that's the other big message in my book, is you've got to start with those who are in the marginalized communities.
Right.
The policymakers really aren't listening to them. What are their needs? You know, a lot of times it's basic things like affordable childcare, or I mean, clearly affordable housing, but benefits.
Right.
You know, things that we could address as a society. Many European countries have. But we instead don't want to provide those things, and we want to let everybody find them on their own.
You're listening to Take Back Radio here at 102.3 FM San Rafael or radio.dominican.edu. Our guest today is Professor Laura Stivers here at Dominican University of California, and her fantastic book, Disrupting Homelessness, Alternative Christian Approaches. And this was published in 2011. So it's been a few years, but this is still an incredible hot topic, if not more, right now, as we have a new president and still talking about this issue and more. Has homeless rates gone up or down or fluctuated at all, or has anything changed since the publication of your book that you can tell?
I still think homelessness is a major problem across the United States, and particular cities have, especially the Bay Area. I know I'm from Seattle area. They're really struggling with homelessness. I've looked at the figures just nationwide, and in fact, the chronic homeless population has gone down since 2010. in part because of the Housing First policies that I was talking about.
What does chronic mean when you describe it that way?
So there's really three types of homelessness. One is chronic homelessness. Those are the people that have been on the streets for a long time, usually have some major addiction issues or mental health. And the statistics vary, but generally what I've found is it's about 20% of the homeless population. Yet when we think about homelessness, that's the population we think of because they're visible. They're the ones we see
right.
on the street.
Right.
There's also transitional homelessness and episodic homelessness. Transitional would just be a person or family who was homeless once or twice, usually because of a traumatic event, whether it's an eviction or a divorce or maybe even domestic abuse.
Right.
And episodic homelessness would be individual or family that episodically is homeless. They're not chronically homeless. They're not on the streets all the time, but they routinely have issues. They're evicted routinely, or they're, you know, living with family and friends, doubled up. And in my book, I note that, you know, our ideologies of who is homeless and kind of blaming the poor is really based on those people who are chronically homeless, when in fact the majority of the homeless people who are homeless are not chronically homeless. They're either transitional or episodically homeless. And many of them are families. I think when I did the research for the book, I found that the average age of a person who's homeless is 9.
Wow. In our own country.
And I think that population has increased because poverty's increased and housing costs have increased. And so that's where we really need to be looking. I mean, clearly we want to help those who are chronically homeless as well. But the way we're going to best address the rest of the population that are often what we call the hidden homeless, we don't see them on the streets. They're either in shelters or transitional housing. They might be living in hotels that are cheap, camping, living with other family members, you know, couch surfing.
Sure.
Doubled up. You know, families doubled up in small quarters. They're not technically homeless, but that's really the hidden homeless. They don't really have a place that they have a safe, secure space to live.
Or the means of sustaining themselves.
Yeah.
Right.
And so the population of the chronically homeless has gone down since 2010 because of the Housing First policy. That population, we have pretty accurate numbers. Every January, they do a count and count, where they go in the streets in each city, and they count the people who are on the streets and the shelters, and that generally is the people who are chronically homeless.
Right.
I know in Marin, the last point and count, they had about 950 people who are homeless, but that's not the whole number. We actually don't have good numbers on those who are the hidden homeless, because how do you know if people are doubled up or camping and they're actually homeless or living in their car? I mean, that's been increasingly an issue.
Sure.
There was just something on NPR this morning down in Palo Alto that people come in to park in the parking lot and there's cars in there where people are sleeping in their cars.
Wow.
And so that population, it's hard to say whether it's gone up or down. We are doing a little bit better since the recession. More people are employed. But, you know, a third of the homeless are actually employed. So just having more jobs doesn't mean people are out of homelessness.
So how did we get here? You talk in your book about policies the last 30 years specifically. I wondered if you could address that. Obviously the idea of homelessness goes before that, and we've had our ups and downs in this country, but it's certainly a problem today. Have policies in the last 30 years affected this to the point? Certainly globalization has played a part, and we were talking a little bit about that.
I think policies really since the 80s have affected. That's 80s is when homelessness began to spike. And that was really the kind of the turn when we moved towards more neoliberal economics. An emphasis on deregulation of corporations, environmental regulations, that sort of thing. Privatization, where we say we don't want the government providing things, but we want the private sector to provide things. So, for example, we contract out welfare provision. Many prisons are privatized. I mean, we could go the gamut on all the things that are privatized. Wage policies, like minimum wage now does not purchase the amount that it used to. We finally just raised it a little bit, which is helpful. But the purchasing power of minimum wage has gone down since it was instituted. And since the 80s, wages for 80% of the population have gone down. For the top 20% have done really well since the 80s.
So what we're talking about is that trickle-down economics, too. That
yeah, but it's not even, formula. I mean, it, you know, Reagan was only in office for so long, and we've had Democratic presidents, but we continue this kind of trend towards neoliberal economics.
Right.
And, you know, even Clinton signed welfare reform, which basically limited welfare to a lifetime limit of 5 years. It devolved the responsibility to the states, and the states could decide if people could be on welfare for a year at a time or up to 2 years at a time. Some states really cut back, others didn't. But, you know, it basically cut off a lot of people from support. And that's been kind of the trend, is that we're, well, the other, you mentioned globalization. When Reagan came into office, he was very anti-union, and that started the trend towards having less union representation in our country. But we also have become a globalization has affected us because now workers are competing with workers around the world. We used to be more of an industrial society. Many of our blue-collar unionized jobs have disappeared because, you know, the car manufacturers, the textile mills, all of these have just gone to other countries, whether it's Central America, Mexico, China. And so we've become more of a service economy. It's much harder to unionize service workers because they tend, it's not like a big factory, but it's smaller entities. Service jobs pay less, and they tend to be more contingent work, which means you might be contracted out, or you might be part-time, or it's not your full-time 40-an-hour sure. week with benefit jobs.
Right.
And so now people don't have the benefits, often not getting pension, and don't have stable, secure work. And that's been happening really since the 80s. I mean, part of it's that U.S. doesn't have the economic hegemony that it used to have. You know, after the World War II, we kind of rebuilt Europe, and that fueled a big growth period. But now we have a lot of competition.
Sure.
From other countries.
Sure. It was in China in the 1990s, the early 90s, when there was a big move for companies to move to China for joint ventures. Mm-hmm. And it was all very exciting because there was this vision at the time of, you know, uniting with other countries in a business way, which would help bring a commonality, you know, a place where we could all unite and maybe even foster more global peace. And, you know, we're all together in this, right? And I remember that. And I remember that, you know, because I was in China, I was in Nanjing at the time, and I was meeting a lot of American business people who were working with the Chinese. The Chinese were very careful. They, you know, ensured they had that 50% of the pie. They weren't going to give themselves away mm-hmm. like they had done in a previous generation. But I look at that now and I go, wow, you know, that we really just gave it all away, didn't we? But on the other hand, one could argue at that point in time where unions had a stronghold and it was hard to do business here in the United States, we were paying high prices. You know, I don't know what's true mm. and how that could have been solved differently. Or was that really a problem? Or was that just a created, that was a problem that was just talked about
yeah,
and not,
I'm not
didn't
I'm not
exist?
Sure about
I don't
that.
Know.
Yeah.
Right.
I would say, though, that the deregulation that began in the 80s has really affected housing and homelessness.
Yeah.
The savings and loans were the main source of home loans. And savings and loans couldn't do all sorts of other financial things. And then when they got deregulated, home loans, mm-hmm. you know, that's not a big moneymaker. And so those kind of disappeared.
Yeah.
And then you had the savings and loan crisis because of that. The whole mortgage foreclosure crisis was really because of deregulation.
Yeah.
The things that these banks were doing was legal.
Right.
But it...
Was it moral?
Created a big... obviously not. And it made huge amounts of money for the top 20% or the top 10%. And millions of people lost their homes. And it wasn't just the homeowners. Many people who were renting in homes that became foreclosed. So it affected renters quite heavily.
Right, right. Well, I do remember that union bust of 1981. That was the catalyst for all unions in the United States.
Send a message.
I remember it well.
If you can bust the white men air traffic controllers, then you could, you know.
Yeah.
If you're going to take their privilege away, that was a big message.
It was a big message for all unions. That's when it all started to disassemble.
But it wasn't.
Country.
I mean, I think that was the. That was the start of it, but I think globalization is also very much weakened unions.
Yeah. It's well, what good things can we talk about? I mean, is this a catalyst for communities to come together? I mean, what can we as the people take from this? You know, our government is, you know, doing new things today. There's a lot of anger. There's a lot of division arising. Is there?
My main message in my book is that you can't address these things alone. You have to work in groups. You can't address everything. Pick something that's of interest to you. If it's healthcare policy, then work with a group to try to keep the Affordable Care Act, where people actually have health insurance and healthcare. If it's affordable housing, then work in your community to try to promote affordable housing. If it's transportation and a more sustainable transportation options than just cars, work on that, or bike lanes.
Right.
But we can't do any of this by ourselves. We have to work in groups.
And what's interesting about what you say, local advocacy, I mean, isn't there some wisdom in trying to cultivate one area as a kind of as an ideal, whether it's the bicycle lanes or local health care or community coming together in order to set a stage and sort of message about how other communities could be too? I mean, if you could create some sort of standard.
I guess I part of yes and no. Yes, local communities need to do that, but a lot of these bigger issues need a regional focus.
Yeah.
And that's been part of what's been a struggle in Marin, is there is a regional Bay Area Association of Bay Area Government that's trying to do a more regional focus to think about transportation options and housing options.
Right.
Because you can't, as a local community, you can't, I mean, you can't build the subways or the you know, smart trains. You have to do it as a region.
Yes.
And even housing is better done thinking regionally. So yes, I think local communities should come together, but I think we do need to think about regions when we're thinking. I mean, I'm a big advocate of smart growth, where we have more less sprawling big mansions.
Yes.
A little bit denser housing. I'm not saying high rises everywhere, but a little bit denser housing where we protect our green spaces still. I mean, I love living in Marin because of the protected open space.
Yes.
And we have a lot more public transportation.
Yeah.
And so that people, and more affordable housing options so that people can actually live where they work and don't have to travel far.
Well, I guess some of the good news is this, is as we're talking more about being responsible for our carbon footprint, it's bringing in more awareness about living big lifestyles, living in those big homes, having the big cars is very detrimental to the rest of us. And being responsible for that, for the amount of poundage of carbon that you emit. And that's, you know, slowly coming. I recently did a class on it to discover that, you know, the people who are living small and resourcefully are the ones who are going to look really good pretty soon versus those living in the big houses.
I think there's more awareness, but I think there actually has to be policies that really either demand that people make changes or incentivize.
Right.
So ways that we can make public transportation affordable and incentivize people to use it, or smart, you know, electric cars.
Yes.
Or ways that we can make housing attractive that's smaller housing and it's more green housing.
Did you hear about that recent story about the Powell Street station, BART station, and how a disaster it is? I mean, it's pretty disgusting.
Yeah, again, on NPR yesterday, they were talking about the spate of crime happening on the BART trains.
Really? Now, if our politicians were required to take public transportation? Yeah. Wouldn't that be a lead-in to say, hey, if it's good enough to be there, it's good enough for you, and start making our politicians and the people who manage those resources start living by them?
No, I just spent some time in Spain with a student group from Dominican, and I was just in Barcelona a week ago, and we used public transportation for everywhere we went. Every time we came down to a train, it was no more than a 2-minute wait. The trains were full of people of all class levels. There was no reason to drive in the city because it would have taken you longer. It was quicker to go by bus and train. And people lived in apartments. So I'm not saying we all have to have, you know, high crowded, dense apartment living everywhere. But to have homes over, you know, 2,000 square feet for a family of four is kind of crazy.
Yeah.
We don't need to be using all that space.
That's right. I was actually in Tacoma, Washington last month.
That's where I grew up.
Really? Yeah. I loved that town. Yeah. It was. I saw some really great things in that town. It was part of the Liberal Arts Symposium. Mm-hmm. Dominican, another Reed was there. Stanford was there. It was a fantastic symposium. But they had a free train that went through the middle of town. It was called the Link, I think, right?
Yeah, but that's just it doesn't take you anywhere.
Okay, but we're talking about at least you got to start somewhere. You got to start somewhere. And for me, you know, being a tourist, or, you know, I had some business there. Yeah. I can't say I was a complete tourist, but anyway, trying to get around, there was such this sense of relief versus going to London where I was last year and trying to figure out the tube. I think I stood there for an hour trying to figure it out. Now, but I'm talking about more about the ease of something, because when it's not so difficult to use, you actually use it. If you know you're going to be standing there forever and it may not come, and that happens, I've, you know, taken transportation here as well. I have my electric bike now. You have to see this show.
Yeah.
You actually get around better than a car. It's amazing. But
well, right now in the United States, our public transportation is considered something poor people only take. Some of the subways in D.C. and the Bay Area and such are used by commuters as well that aren't poor. And of course, New York City would be an exception. But
just lost our train
unless
here in California.
Unless we decide to put money towards public transportation and quit putting it all towards roads, we'll continue to be a car economy.
I was thinking about it the other day, and tell me if this makes sense. You know, in order to get around today, be functioning and have a job and do all the things you need to do, you have to have a car, which requires car insurance, smog checks, gas, which is expensive, cheaper than Europe for sure, but you got to drive further in order to do anything. Traffic is horrible. Then we are taxed for the roads. We are completely financially subsidizing and paying for an entire transportation system while somebody else is making the bucks off all of this. I'm trying to understand how that all works for the common person. I think that's where I'm going. I had a car towed a couple of months ago, and I ended up in the garage, and the garage was filled with cars that have been sitting there for months because people can't afford to get their car out. Mm-hmm. And those are the poorest people.
Yeah.
$300 to get your car out if you get it out that night. And if you don't, then it goes up to like $700, $1,000. It's outrageously expensive.
Many of the poorest people can't own cars. And so they're relying on the transportation that doesn't run regularly or doesn't go to where they live, or and it limits where they can live. I mean, I know where I live, there's a bus that commutes into San Francisco on the weekdays, but there's nothing on the weekends.
Yeah.
So a person who was in poverty, well, they couldn't afford to live where I'm living, but they also couldn't live there because there's no transportation.
So these are easy fixes.
We end up segregating our communities in that way.
Mm.
But we could design things differently. There are many examples of that around the world, but it's a matter of choice.
How do you think Spain has been able to set the mind?
Well, I think for one thing, those cities were developed before the creation of the car.
Okay. Oh, well, that's an easy one, perhaps. Yeah.
Our cities, especially in California, were developed after the creation of the car. I mean, not complete, you know, San Francisco was, but the San yeah. Francisco you can see wasn't developed around the car, but LA was.
LA was, that's why that's
it's
right.
It's a massive sprawl because you had a car.
And they did try to get the trains in there at one stage. I think it was in the 1980s. Mm-hmm. There's a great film about that. And yeah. it was the automobile industry that actually pushed for that not to happen.
And they didn't have as much open space. They had a denser population, so they had to build apartments and denser housing.
Right.
We've had the luxury of lots of open space in the United States, and so we can just keep sprawling outwards. But we're getting to a point where that's not sustainable anymore.
So if we could circle back to some of those...
to homelessness?
Well, it's all part of it, right? I mean, it's interesting what you were saying. You used to teach an environmental ethics mm-hmm. class, too, which is really interesting how that it's really all ties into one and the same, doesn't mm-hmm. it? One leads to the other.
Well, they're totally interconnected.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And getting back onto a positive note, I mean, this incredible problem that concerns all of us. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're all part of this formula. How do we all take a responsibility toward that?
Well, I think the first thing we need to realize is we need to quit being accustomed to seeing people who are homeless. We need to see it as an outrage. We don't see it as an outrage anymore. We just see it as inevitable. That this is just a result of either person's bad behavior or inequality and poverty that we can't address. And that's not true. There are countries in this world that don't have many people who are homeless because they've addressed it through policies, or in some cultures also have more extended communities where they care for their family members. We tend to be a little bit more isolated in this country. So that's the first thing, is just realizing that this is something we can address. It's not inevitable. And then begin to work with others. And that was my, my field is Christian ethics. And my message for churches was, okay, yes, you're doing great work in providing shelters or food kitchens or whatever, different things. Some groups are even building some affordable housing. But how are you going to do that and work to help change policies, work with others to say, we need to create communities where no one's homeless and where people have enough money to afford health care. It's not a privilege, it's a right. Health care is a right, where people can afford to have good quality child care, and so on. I could keep going on.
Well, you are listening to Laura Stivers, professor of at university. I'm sorry, I'm babbling away here because this is a really important subject. It gets me very emotional, actually. I get very emotional listening to this. Laura Stivers is here with me talking about homelessness. She's the author of Disrupting Homelessness, Alternative Christian Approaches. You're a professor here at Dominican University of California. You've been here for a number of years.
Seven years.
Well, you were my professor. And your class, I have to throw this out, because it was your environmental ethics class that kicked me in the butt. It was the very first class I took as a graduate student here at Dominican. And I was on the edge of my seat going, oh, this is so wrong. This is so wrong. What are we doing to this planet? And you got me riled up.
Now we got to get you into the economic justice class. I'll get you riled up.
That's why I'm here today on this radio show. Yeah. I mean, honestly, full circle. So this is, I guess, maybe emotional while you're here right now with me. Because you just realize how these little things can just trigger you in life and kick you in the butt and go, I need to do something about this, you know?
Well, and that's, I mean, my field of Christian ethics, the whole, you know, my point is that if we really, if I'm going to call myself Christian and others who are Christian, this has got to be a concern of ours. Anybody can be concerned about poverty, inequality, homelessness, but if you're claiming to be Christian or even another religious tradition, this should be your emphasis. You should be saying that we shouldn't have people who are out on the streets or in substandard housing. I don't think God, Jesus would have promoted any of that.
Wow. Well, thanks for sharing all of this. And thanks so much for coming on this show. Who knows, maybe your book will slowly start a movement and we'll all get behind you in this vision, because it's really great, great work. It's a great conversation. And it's really what we all need to be hearing and getting into action with right now. You're listening to Take Back the Universe Loves to Laugh on 102.3 FM or worldwideradio.dominican.edu. I really want to say thank you to Professor Laura Stivers. Your book is available online.
Yep.
And again, her book is called Disrupting Homelessness, Alternative Christian Approaches. Next week, we have Jessica Niefsi. She is an artist and an ecological designer living on the Big Sur coast of California. She's an ocean and nature lover, and her new clothing line, Anima California, embodies affection and reverence for the wildlife we live with. No, this is not a plug for fashion, but it's what she is doing with it that we really want to talk about. It's a sustainable-driven mission that's really setting a new model for what I call good business. And again, thank you so much to Professor Laura Stivers. We'll see you next week. And until then, get out there and start making a difference. We'll talk to you again next week. Thanks so much for joining us on Take Back. Just promise you-